Here we have table 24, a NAND gate. There's four columns, input P, input Q, P and Q, and then the output, not P and Q. If P and Q are zero, then P and Q is zero, and the output, not P and Q, is one. If P is zero and Q is one, P and Q is zero, and the output, not P and Q, is one. If P is one and Q is zero, P and Q is zero, and the output, not P and Q, is again one. And if P is one and Q is one, then P and Q is one, and the output, not P and Q, is zero. This can again be drawn graphically in figure 65, which shows P and Q entering an AND gate, and the output of that entering a NOT gate, with not P and Q coming out. As a time saver, rather than drawing out a NOT gate and an AND gate separately, we'll just merge them as a single gate, NAND, which we'll draw as below. And here we have figure 66, a NAND gate, which just shows P and Q entering that rounded square from before, but now with a circle on the tip, labeled NAND, and not P and Q coming out. That NAND gate is functionally identical to the NOT AND gate we first made, but easier to draw. And we can continue to combine gates using a NAND gate, an OR gate, and an AND gate to make a new gate that outputs one if and only if one of its inputs is one. Anything else, and we'll return zero. We call this gate exclusive OR, and here's how you build it. Figure 67 shows an exclusive OR gate. It has P and Q entering both a NAND gate and an OR gate, and the output from each of those entering an AND gate, which produces P exclusive OR Q. The truth table for an exclusive OR gate is given in table 25, labeled a truth table proving that you can make an exclusive OR gate out of a NAND, an OR, and an AND gate. It has five columns. Input P, input Q, P NAND Q, P OR Q, and the output, P exclusive OR Q. If P and Q are both zero, P NAND Q is one, P OR Q is zero, and P exclusive OR Q is zero. If P is zero but Q is one, P NAND Q is one, P OR Q is one, and P exclusive OR Q is one. If P is one and Q is zero, P NAND Q is one, P OR Q is one, and again, P exclusive OR Q is one. If P and Q are both one, P NAND Q is zero, P OR Q is one, and P exclusive OR Q is zero. And just like NAND, we can give this collection of gates its own symbol, the exclusive OR symbol. This is shown in figure 68, which is the chevron shape we saw for OR, with a line at the side labeling it exclusive OR. P and Q enter the exclusive OR gate, and P exclusive OR Q comes out. Fun fact, besides the NAND and exclusive OR gates you just invented, you can actually construct a gate that produces any patterns of output you can imagine from just the AND, OR, and NOT gates you started with. Footnote, these gates are called universal for this reason. Any set of gates that can emulate AND, OR, and NOT is universal. Incredibly, you don't even need all three of these to make a universal set. An OR gate can be emulated with the proper sequence of ANDs and NOTs. P OR Q is the same as NOT, NOT P, and NOT Q. Therefore, just NOT and AND are a set of universal gates. In fact, NOT and AND in a single gate, NAND, is a universal gate all by itself, which means a whole bunch of NAND gates is literally all you need to build a complete computer. NOT and OR are universal gates too, making NOR the only other universal single gate operation. End footnote. Okay, so, great. I've invented all these gates, but none of them add anything yet, so what the heck? Right. Well, let's define what an addition gate should look like. Let's start with the basics, adding two single-digit binary numbers. This gives us a manageable-looking truth table of all possible outcomes. Here we have table 26, labeled, incredibly, not the first time in this book we've explained that 1 plus 1 equals 2. There are four columns, P, Q, the output, P plus Q in decimal, and the output, P plus Q in binary. 0 plus 0 gives you 0 in decimal and 0 in binary. 0 plus 1 gives you 1 in decimal and 1 in binary. 1 plus 0 gives you 1 in decimal and 1 in binary. But 1 plus 1 gives you 2 in decimal and 1 0 in binary. The catch is, binary deals in ones and zeros, and you've got a binary 1-0 there, that's a 2, in your output. So let's break our output out into two different channels, each representing a single binary digit, like so. Here we have table 27, which has four columns, P, Q, output A, output B. It's the same table we saw before in table 26, with the output split into two. So, if P and Q are 0, output A is 0 and B is 0. If P is 0 and Q is 1, output A is 0, output B is 1. If P is 1 and Q is 0, output A is 0 and output B is 1. But if P is 1 and Q is 1, then output A is 1 and output B is 0. Now, two inputs representing the two single-digit binary numbers you want to add go in, and two outputs representing the two-digit solution, again in binary, come out. We've labeled those A and B here, and together, they encode what the input digits add up to. All we need to do is figure out how to construct this from the gates we've already got. AND, OR, NOT, NAND, and exclusive OR. Footnote, and yes, you've probably noticed that while we've defined what these gates should do, we still haven't figured out how to actually build any of them yet. Don't worry, we'll get there. Probably. End footnote. If you look at the patterns of ones and zeros produced by A and B, you'll notice they look familiar. A's output is identical to an AND gate, and B corresponds perfectly with an exclusive OR gate. This makes building it really simple. All you have to do is connect the inputs to an AND gate and to a separate exclusive OR gate, like so, and your adding machine is invented. And here we have figure 69, an adding machine. P and Q go into an exclusive OR gate, which outputs A, and P and Q also feed into an AND gate, which outputs B. With that, you've defined the operation of a machine that can add 1 and 1 together. Now, since you already know what 1 plus 1 equals, footnote, it's 2. We really thought you knew the answer for that already. End footnote. This machine, called a half adder, probably seems pretty useless. But let's look at how addition works one more time. In the decimal system you're used to, 7 plus 1 equals 8, 8 plus 1 equals 9, but 9 plus 1 gives you a two-digit answer, 10. Since we only have digits that go from 0 to 9, when numbers get larger, we have to carry the 1 and start a new column, a double-digit 10 instead of a single-digit 9. That exact same thing happens in binary, but instead of carrying the 1 to start a new column at 10, we start a new column at 2. Given that, we can relabel our A and B outputs with more accurate names. Let's call them S for sum and C for carry. If C is 1, we need to carry that 1 over into a new binary digit. And something really interesting happens if you take a half adder and connect it to another half adder with an exclusive OR gate. This new machine, which we'll call a full adder, looks like this. Here we have figure 70, a full adder. There's three inputs now, P, Q, and an input C. And there's two outputs, S and our output C. As before, P and Q feed into an exclusive OR gate and are fed into an AND gate. The output of that first exclusive OR gate is run through another exclusive OR, this time against the input C. This produces S. To produce that output C, we AND the result of our input C and the result of that first exclusive OR gate. We then exclusive OR that against the result of our first AND gate. This produces the output C. This new machine we described just now still outputs your solution as S and C, which remember represent sum and carry, like before, but now it can take a different C as input. This C lets you carry the 1 from another full adder's result and feed it into this one. You can therefore chain full adders together. This is where the magic happens. With each full adder you include in your machine, you double the maximum number that machine can handle. One full adder outputs two binary digits, which gives you four numbers you can output, from 0 to 3. Two full adders gives you three binary digits, so now you can count eight different numbers. Three full adders gets you to 16, four gets you to 32, and from there you reach 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, 4096, 8192, 16384, and so on, doubling with each new full adder you include. By the time you have 42 full adders chained together, you have built a machine that can count high enough to give every star in the visible universe its own unique number. That's pretty good for a bunch of weird imaginary gates you just made up. These adders are the heart of your calculation engine. All you need for multiplication, subtraction, and division is addition. All you need for addition is to build full adders. And all you need for full adders is to build actual, real-life versions of the logic gates you've invented. If you can build these gates, you've solved computers. Footnote: you may be noticing that these full adders only work with positive whole numbers, and it's true. But you can solve this by setting one binary digit, say the one farthest on the left, to be your sign digit, 0 for positive, say, and 1 for negative. And to work with non-whole numbers like 2.452262, you just need to remember where in your binary digit you want the decimal place to be, and everything else proceeds the same way. End footnote. So, let's actually build some logic gates and solve computers. Eventually, your civilization will build computers that run on electricity. But to start, you're going to build a computer that runs on something easier to manage than a visible electron flow. You're going to build a computer that runs on water. This may sound difficult, and indeed, building a NOT gate that turns 0 into 1, or in other words, a machine that, when no water is going into it, somehow summons water as output, can be tricky, but your full adder only used AND and exclusive OR gates, and you're about to invent both of those at the same time with a single piece of technology. And here it is. And here we have figure 71. Imagine a circle with two tunnels into it at the top and one tunnel coming out the bottom. In the center of this circle, there's a basin to catch water. The inputs are your water flowing in under pressure at the top, P and Q. The bucket catching water in the middle leads to an output labeled AND, and the pipe catching water at the bottom leads to an output labeled exclusive OR. When only one or the other of those inputs is on, the water shoots over the bucket in the middle and sluices down out the bottom, turning the exclusive OR gate on and the AND gate off. But if water shoots in from both inputs, it hits in the middle and drops down into the AND bucket, which means the AND gate is on and the exclusive OR gate is off. Figure 71 is labeled an apparatus that functions as both a fluidic AND gate and a fluidic exclusive OR gate at the same time. If one or the other inputs is on, the water sluices in from the top, whips around the sides, and comes out the bottom. But if both are on, they impact in the middle and water comes out there instead. The output from the bottom is the exclusive OR of the inputs, and the output from the middle is the AND of the inputs. This combination exclusive OR and AND gate is all you need to build a full adder, and therefore, it's also all you need to make a computer that runs on water. In other words, properly configured water is all that's needed to perform computational tasks. Done. Footnote: and with the exclusive OR gate we've got, you'll see that a fluidic NOT gate isn't actually as impossible as it sounded. If you build a truth table for P exclusive OR 1, i.e., the exclusive OR of P with an always-on flow, you'll see that the output is the same as NOT P. End footnote. All of this said, a water-based computer will obviously be slower than the speed of electricity itself ones that you remember, and they won't act as a replacement for the latest mass-market portable music players for a very long time, if ever. But it's the foundation of computation that humans normally even don't start glancing at until the late 1600s CE, and miniaturization, electronics, semiconductors, and everything that comes afterward will be built upon what you've just invented. You've not only figured out the basics of mechanical computation, you've built a machine that actually solves mathematical problems using these principles. And you don't need to stick with water. Remember, any machine that produces the output you want works as a gate, and besides the water gates you have, and the electrical gates you'll someday construct, you can explore other mediums. Marbles running through grooves, ropes and pulleys, and even living crabs have been used to construct logic gates. Footnote: For ropes and pulleys, the idea here is to have different heights of a weighted pulley marked as 1 and 0. Say that 0 is down and up is 1. If you pull the cord on a vertical pulley above you down, then the weight on the other end goes up. That's the basics of a NOT gate. By adding extra cords and weights, you can construct AND and OR gates pretty easily, which gives you a universal set. Second footnote. In 2012 CE, humans discovered that the soldier crabs found on the beaches and lagoons of islands in Japan behave in predictable ways. They range in color from pale to dark blue, lightening as they get older, with shells from 8 millimeters to 16 millimeters long. Specifically, these crabs travel in swarms and tend to hug walls, and when two swarms collide, they merge and head off in a direction that combines the direction the two swarms were moving in. An OR gate is as easy as constructing crab pathways in a Y shape. The crabs enter from the top of the Y and exit at the bottom, even if two swarms collide. An AND gate is an X shape, but with an added vertical line from the middle of the X to the bottom. Crabs enter the top diagonally and proceed out the bottom in the same way, but when two swarms collide, they'll move out the vertical line you added. That's your AND output. The scientists who discovered the computational potential of these crabs noted that they were sometimes prone to error. It turns out that living animals are not as perfectly predictable as streams of water or electrons, which, along with the absence of a NOT gate to give you a universal set, may indicate some upcoming challenges in your dream of realizing large-scale computational machinery powered by lil crabs. End footnote. It's worth noting that most of these gates were invented after we invented electronic computers. Once humans have the basics of binary logic, they start seeing ways to invent computers out of all sorts of things. The next major innovation will be general-purpose computing machines. The computers you just invented are built to do a single thing, but as soon as you can program your machines with numbers, rather than programming them by physically moving gates, you begin to blur the line between numbers that mean things and numbers that do things. This gives computers the ability to alter their own programming as they run. And once you have that, the potential of computation explodes, and the world is never the same. It's gonna be great! Conclusion. Things should now be pretty comfortable for you, and you're welcome. It turns out that learning enough to survive in the distant past was simply a matter of time. This is, sadly, where our guide comes to an end. In it, you have found answers to some of the most profoundly life-changing questions humans have ever asked, including, what is the universe made of? Section 11. What are things, and how do I make things? How can I live in comfort and not die for a while? Section 5. Now we are become farmers, the devourers of worlds. And, I keep pooping too much, and would like to do that less in the future, so does anyone know anything I should do to make that happen? Section 14. Heal somebody. We're absolutely certain that this knowledge will serve you well in the days, months, and years to come. As you step out of your state-of-the-art FC-3000 rental market time machine and survey an unknown Earth, one soon to be transformed into a home, a community, and a civilization, we are envious. You are about to enter a world of untold wonder and potential, and you will face it with a gift the rest of humanity never had. The gift of foresight. Use it wisely, and you'll reach heights greater than we ever dreamed, all while avoiding our most terrible and harmful pitfalls. Reading this book has transferred knowledge of humanity's greatest achievements from the palm of your hand to the interior of your mind. Earlier, we remarked that this text, once stranded in the past, was the single most powerful and dangerous thing on the planet. That is no longer true. You are. Go get 'em, Tiger. And here we have figure 72 showing the FC-3000 time machine in the primordial past. A dinosaur in the foreground looks at it. Figure 72 is labeled, despite everything, the FC-3000. With warmest professional regards from your friends at Chronautic Solutions. Afterward. Hey, it's me, Ryan, again. With what you just heard, the original text ends, leaving the stranded time traveler to their now hopefully much improved fate. I can almost summon the emotions they must have felt upon completing this book and looking up from it out to a new world. Satisfaction at having learned so much, mixed in with the complete and abject terror of having to rebuild everything ever from first principles in a random time period. Pretty intense. Glad I don't have to worry about that. Besides some really good books, I also consulted some really good humans when I was verifying this text I found. I'd like to thank my brother, Victor North, for his knowledge of both art and brewing, and my friends Dr. Priya Raju for sharing her secrets of the medical profession, Aline Choman and Will Wadley for their knowledge of music and musical theory, David Melke for his knowledge of flight, and Mike Tucker for his knowledge of boats. Huge thanks to Zach Wienersmith, Randall Monroe, Jen Klug, Mike Tucker, Emily Horn, and my dad for being beta readers, with a particular shout out to Randall for instantly knowing how much land would be covered if the ice caps completely melted this afternoon. He practically volunteered that information before I even asked. Thanks to Dr. Alain Deval for helping me research the laws surrounding the preserved corpses of accused criminals in France in 1670 CE, and to Sergio Aragonés for being so kind when I asked him about his experiences with iceboxes. Finally, my editor Courtney Young was invaluable, and everyone should work with her because she's great, except don't, because I still wanted to work with me. Any errors that remain are my own. I must have introduced them when I transcribed the guide, or when I read it out, just now. To you. Ryan North, Toronto, 2018 CE. You made it. Welcome to the appendix section. I'll be going over the appendices available in the text, but you should really go to howtoinventeverything.com to see them in full. Here we'll get mostly the highlights, except for Appendix J, which is the exclusive appendix only to this audio recording. You'll want to stick around for that. The first appendix is Appendix A, Technology Tree. There are some technologies that can be invented all on their own, and others that require other technologies be invented first. The ones that can be invented all on their own are farming, written language, spoken language, non-sucky numbers, the scientific method, buttons, birth control, and compasses. As we mentioned in the text, kilns, smelters, and forges lead to tons of different technologies, including horseshoes, steel, cement and concrete, glass, batteries, salt production, and computers. Some of the technologies that require the most prerequisites are preserved foods, boats, and human flight. Appendix B, the periodic table. This table looks like one you might recognize, but with a lot of additions. There's an endnote describing it. This periodic table is obviously much larger than the one you and I are familiar with. Our table stops at element 118, and this one goes all the way to 172. Interestingly, our current understanding suggests that 172 may be an atomic limit. At 173, the atoms would be so large that the electrons on its outer shell would have to move at speeds faster than light. While most of these new elements are named after scientists, which is in line with our current naming conventions, there are a few that have Latin phrases at their core, including in principium, meaning in the beginning, used for the final element at 172, praevidarium, meaning foresee, suggesting that it may be of some use in time travel, and the alarmingly named male passanovium, or bad news itself. I can offer no explanation for these names. End note. Appendix C, useful chemicals, how to make them, and how they can definitely kill you. Included in this section are instructions to produce all the chemicals required in this text, along with other substances useful in building a civilization. They are listed with prerequisites first, so later chemicals are produced using chemicals already described. And before you get too excited and begin producing chemicals willy-nilly, know that there's a reason each chemical listed on the following pages has a how it can definitely kill you by accident section, and that's because they're dangerous substances that can definitely kill you by accident. Be careful, and don't make anything here unless you're trapped in the past and really, really need it. Again, the full appendix is available on howtoinventeverything.com, but I'll give you my favorite chemical, which is listed under C.8, sodium hydroxide, and potassium hydroxide, also known as caustic soda for sodium hydroxide, or caustic potash for potassium hydroxide, or as lye for both. The formula is NaOH for sodium hydroxide and KOH for potassium hydroxide. It appears as a white solid. It was first synthesized in 200 CE. Its description reads, "Both sodium and potassium hydroxide are used in making soaps. Since they dissolve organic tissues, they're useful for cleaning things like brewing vats." How to produce? Both these chemicals have historically been called lye, since both can generally be substituted for each other in most contexts. While sodium hydroxide can be produced with little more than salt water and electricity, you can also produce it from wood ashes. Run water through ashes, see C.5 and C.6 for details, and add slaked lime, see C.4. Lye, which will either be potassium hydroxide or sodium hydroxide, depending on whether you used potassium carbonate or sodium carbonate, will be produced, with calcium carbonate settling at the bottom. How this can definitely kill you by accident. Listen, these chemicals are known as caustic because they dissolve the proteins and fats in living tissues. You are made out of living tissues, which means that lye is not something you want to have on or near you. It will cause chemical burns on contact, and if you get it in your eyes, you can go blind. Caustics have even been used to decompose organic tissues into a slurry in an attempt to dispose of human bodies. Civilization pro tip, if things are going well, you should not need to get rid of any human bodies. Appendix D, logical argument forms. This appendix has a list of symbols and words describing the valid argument forms we know about. You can read it on howtoinventeverything.com, but I'll give you my favorite. If P and Q are true, then P is also true. Always had a soft spot for that one. The table is labeled Table 28. Please enjoy this list of correct argument forms that took humanity thousands of years of reasoning to figure out, but which now rates only 2 pages printed at the end of a book. Appendix E, trigonometry tables, included because you'll need them when you invent sundials, but they'll also be useful if you ever decide to invent trigonometry. This book is a guide to reinventing civilization from scratch, and while your civilization will eventually want to invent trigonometry, in an era where you don't know where your next meal is coming from because you're still figuring out what farming is, you probably don't need it right away. We therefore won't cover the entirety of trig here, but in this appendix, we do give you some of the most useful low-hanging fruit, enough for practical purposes, and to point the way to future discoveries. Trigonometry lets you use some known quantities about a triangle to determine its unknown quantities, and we will interrupt ourselves right now because we can already hear you saying, "Come on, when am I ever going to use this?" Here is when you are going to use this: in navigation, astronomy, music, number theory, engineering, electronics, physics, architecture, optics, statistics, cartography, and more. You already need it just to build a proper sundial in section 10.7.1. Hence the unofficial slogan of trigonometry, "Okay, fine, I guess this actually is pretty important after all." So since it is so important, be sure to read the rest on howtoinventeverything.com. Appendix F, some universal constants that took humanity a while to figure out and which you can now name after yourself. This is presented as a table with 4 columns. It's table 30, the numbers you need to make reality work. The columns are constant, value, description, and notes. The first constant is the speed of light. Its value is 299,792,458 meters per second. This is the speed of light in a vacuum, which is also the ultimate speed limit of the universe. Light, EM radiation, gravitational waves, they can all go this fast and no faster. Notes: light travels more slowly when traveling through different materials. In glass, for example, you'll divide this speed by about 1.5. But even at these speeds, light's so fast that it's not until 1676 CE that anyone manages to prove it doesn't travel instantaneously. The next constant is the speed of sound, which is 343 meters per second. The speed of sound depends on the medium it's moving through. This number is for dry air at 20 degrees centigrade. Sound travels faster in liquids and faster still in solids. Notes: the speed of sound was calculated in 1709 CE by firing a gun at night observing it by telescope a known distance away, and timing how long it took for the sound to be heard after the light arrived. Go to bed early and save yourself some trouble. The next constant is pi. The value of pi goes on forever, but I'll read you the best parts from memory. The value of pi is
9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9 9
distance around its edge, to its diameter, the length of any line dividing a circle in two through its middle. It's an irrational number, which means if you try to write it out using rational numbers, i.e. the numbers you know, it will take forever. It never ends. And as you saw, it never repeats. Notes. We provide the first 768 digits of pi on the website at howtoinventeverything.com because at that point, entirely by coincidence, you get six nines in a row. If you decide to memorize, like I did, and then recite, like I did, the value of pi to someone, this is a great point to do, as many mathematicians in the past have done. Imply you've memorized a lot more by finishing up here and saying 99999, and so on. Endnote. In our timeline, this prank was first suggested by cognitive science professor and Pulitzer Prize winner Douglas Hofstadter. His Pulitzer Prize win wasn't for this joke, for some reason. And endnote. The next constant is acceleration caused by gravity on Earth, which is around 9.8 meters per second squared. This is the rate at which you accelerate in free fall on Earth. This changes depending on the density of the air and other factors, generally ranging from 9.764 meters per second squared to 9.834 meters per second squared. If you want to calculate how long it'll take something to fall, this is the number you start with. Notes. Without air resistance, a ton of bricks and a ton of feathers would fall at the same rate, though humans didn't prove this until 1634 CE. The next constant is the gravitational constant, whose value is 6.67408 times 10 to the negative 11 meters to the 3, kilograms to the negative 1, seconds to the negative 2. In classical physics, the gravitational attraction between two particles of matter is directly proportional to their masses multiplied together, divided by the square of their distance. But you need to multiply all that by this number, the gravitational constant of the universe, to get the actual measurement of force. Notes, alter the gravitational constant of the universe and you'll lose weight, but at an extremely catastrophic cost. And our final constant is the mass of an electron, which is 9.1093836 times 10 to the negative 31 kilograms. All electrons are identical, which, if only for reasons of space when describing them in a book, is really convenient. Notes, before we discovered why all electrons were identical, there was a theory that it was because all electrons were actually the same electron traveling back and forth through time across the entire lifespan of the universe over and over. This theory was as crazy as it was inaccurate, which is to say, very. Endnote. This is actually a real theory proposed in 1940 CE by a real theoretical physicist named John Wheeler, but it was never taken very seriously, even by its inventor. Why are all electrons identical? At this point in time, nobody actually knows why. This theory answers that question. They're all indistinguishable because they're all the same electron, at the expense of raising tons of other, much more challenging questions. End of endnotes. Appendix G. Frequencies for various notes so you can play those cool songs we included. You'll find this at howtoinventeverything.com. Appendix H. A bunch of cool gears and other fundamental mechanisms. Go to howtoinventeverything.com to look at them, but I'll tell you what they are. The first is two gears. The smaller gear will rotate faster than the larger one. Then there are three examples of right angle gears, all transforming horizontal rotation into vertical and vice versa. Then there's a ratchet, which is used to prevent a gear from moving backwards, a crank, which turns rotation into a back and forth horizontal motion and vice versa, and finally a trip hammer, used to transform rotation into a lift and drop motion. Appendix I. Here's where some useful human parts are and what they do. The first part labeled is the brain, a self-aware hunk of fatty meat in an attractive skull container. You can't live without it. It's good at keeping you awake at 2 a.m. just to remind you of all the stupid things you said years and years ago, and it's rated 6 out of 10. It's located in the head. The second is the pharynx. It's a tube for air and food. Weird stretchy folds of flesh beneath these make sounds when you blow on them, which is what makes speaking possible. If it gets blocked, you die, and it's rated 10 out of 10. You can find it in the throat. The next is the cardiovascular system spread throughout the body. The heart moves blood throughout the body. Blood transports nutrients and oxygen to far places. 5,600 cubic centimeters of blood is in the average body, and despite the fact it's cool to know things, people will still question why you have this fact on hand if you volunteered at parties. The cardiovascular system is rated 12 out of 10. Lungs, located in the upper chest, take oxygen from air and put it in blood, and they expel waste as carbon dioxide. Adult lungs contain 6 liters of air in a matching set of meaty carrying cases. They're rated 11 out of 10. Next is arteries and veins, which are found throughout the body. Arteries are high-pressure blood vessels that move blood away from the heart, and veins are low-pressure blood vessels that move blood back into it. Most veins have one-way valves that prevent blood from moving backwards. Sweet. Their ratings are 10 out of 10 for veins and 12 out of 10 for arteries. Next is a urinary bladder located in the abdomen. It contains up to 800 cubic centimeters of warm urine stored in a convenient elastic sac. It allows you to pee on anything you want, whenever you want, a claim no other organ can make. This earns it a rating of 11.5 out of 10. Bone marrow is found within every bone. It produces around 500 billion cells per day, including red blood cells, which deliver oxygen to the body, and white blood cells, which fight infection. 4% of human body mass is bone marrow. Pretty legit. It's rated 9.99 out of 10. In your crotch is the reproductive system, home to 39 million sperm cells, or up to 500,000 egg cells, depending on, well, a lot of things, really. You have to have sex if you want to have babies and continue the species, so you might as well bite the bullet and have some sex. Ratings range from 9.5 out of 10 to 9.725 out of 10. Next is the skeleton. There is a spooky, wet skeleton hiding inside all of us, a truly terrifying thought. The skeleton stores minerals for later use and is secretly hollow, with insides used to produce bone marrow. There are 206 bones in the human body, but a lot of them are pretty samey, rating 8 out of 10. There are lymph nodes spread throughout the body. Lymph is a mixture of water and white blood cells that fights infection. Lymph nodes are part of a network found in the body that swell when infection is present to prevent it from spreading. Lymph also transports fats from the small intestine into the blood, and it's rated 10 out of 10. The stomach in your abdomen is a muscular fleshy bag that contains hydrochloric acid and enzymes. It kills bacteria in food and partially digests it before the small intestine gets to it. The stomach churns, squeezes, and mixes whatever you put into it, earning it a rating of 12.5 out of 10. The pancreas in the abdomen makes both hormones to help regulate the body and enzymes that help digestion. It maintains blood sugar levels and is present in all vertebrates, so it's not that exclusive an organ, but it's still pretty cool. 9 out of 10. The spleen recycles old blood cells and holds a supply of extra blood ready to go whenever you need it. People used to think spleens controlled emotions, but people used to think a lot of things, most of them wrong. 10 out of 10. The liver makes bile that helps the small intestine digest food, and it stores sugars until they're needed, converting stored fat into sugar too. It breaks down toxins and is a truly excellent organ. 13 out of 10. The gallbladder stores and concentrates bile from liver until needed for digestion, but you can live without it. The optionality of this organ earns it a mere 5 out of 10 rating. The intestines are also found in the abdomen. The small intestine breaks down food and absorbs compounds. The large intestine absorbs water and any leftover nutrients. In other words, it turns food into energy and poop. 12 out of 10. The kidneys make urine and produce hormones that keep salt, water, and acid in blood stable. You only need one to live, but most of us have two. Very posh. Kidneys also produce extremely painful kidney stones that you have to pee out. 12 out of 10. And finally, the muscular system includes tissues attached to the skeleton that are controlled by the brain, which lets your brain drive your skeleton around wherever it wants to go. There are lots of muscles throughout the body, and some of them can be pretty attractive if we're being completely honest with each other. 11 out of 10. To see the full image, visit howtometeverything.com. And finally, Appendix J, some delicious recipes for your new civilization. This appendix is just for you, the audiobook listener, because I love you. In our utopic modern era, civilizations are judged by the quality of the culture they produce, and there is no more delicious way to experience any culture than through its food. Included below are two simple recipes you can use to bake, from scratch, the beginnings of your civilization's food culture. Apple pie. Carl Sagan, scientist born in 1934 CE, responsible for, among other things, the pictures of naked humans bolted to the side of the Pioneer spacecraft, which were the first human-built objects to escape our solar system, and which also carried on them a map to Earth to ensure that any extraterrestrial intelligence that found our nudes would definitely know where to go if they wanted some more, once correctly observed that if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe. Luckily, your job isn't that hard. Assuming you're in a time period after which the universe and a hospitable Earth inside it has already formed, the skills you've learned in this book are all you need to do literally everything else. To make an apple pie from scratch, on Earth, all you need to do is invent civilization. And since you've already done that, it's time for pie. Ingredients for crust. 375 grams of flour. To make flour from scratch, first domesticate wheat, in section 5, then pulverize it into powder, either by hand or with the technology described in section 10.5.1, water wheels and windmills. Or, skip domesticating grain and spend more time collecting less convenient undomesticated grain and pulverize that instead. You also need 5 grams of salt. To make salt from scratch, see section 10.2.6. You'll need 188 milliliters of vegetable oil. To make vegetable oil from scratch, you'll need some oily nuts or seeds. Peanuts, walnuts, hazelnuts, pumpkin seeds, or sunflower seeds work well. With modern domesticated plants, you can get a liter of oil from around 2.2 kilograms of peanuts, 1.4 kilograms of walnuts, 1.7 kilograms of hazelnuts, and 2.5 kilograms of pumpkin or sunflower seeds. Grind and press them to extract the oil, You can use a screw press or a modified printing press, section 10.11.2, or even just a grindstone attached to a water wheel, section 10.5.1, as a basic machine to do this. You'll get best results with seeds or nuts that are dry, but not too dry. Too much water will gum up the works. A heated press helps the oil flow better. The next ingredient is 83 milliliters of milk. Domesticate a mammal and then milk it, or tame a wild mammal and then milk it instead. Easy. Instructions for crust. Sift the flour twice to mix it up and remove any clumps, then stir in the salt. To make a spoon and bowl from scratch, carve them from wood, forge them in metal, section 10.4.2, or if you're lazy, just use a stick for a spoon and a turtle shell for a bowl. Pour in the oil and milk. Stir it all together, adding some more milk if the dough seems dry. Divide your dough into two equal parts and roll them out. One's your bottom crust and one is your lid. To make a rolling pin from scratch, carve wood into a tube shape with handles and you're done. Modern rolling pins have rollers on ball bearings, section 10.10.2, so that the pin can roll while the handle stays stationary, but your solid version will work too. It just transfers more friction to your hands, but this pie will be worth it, I promise. Then, put the bottom crust into a pie pan. Construct your pan from clay, section 10.4.2, glass, section 10.4.3, metal, section 10.10.2, or stick with your turtle shell. Failing all that, some of the earliest pies were cooked in wooden boxes over a campfire, with the pastry being used simply to contain the filling, discarded when the pie was finished cooking. Always an option. Ingredients for your apple pie filling. 6 domesticated apples. Domesticate apples the same way you domesticated grain in section 5. If you don't want to wait for domestication, you can use wild apples, but you'll need to gather many more of them to collect enough apple flesh. You're looking for about 0.9 kilograms of seed-free apple meat. We wish there was a less disgusting way to say that than apple meat or apple flesh, but linguists agree this is the only way. If apples haven't evolved yet, feel free to roll the dice on naming some other fruit apples and using it here instead. The next ingredient is 115 grams of sugar. Instructions now to extract sugar can be found in Chapter 7. Any sweetener can be used here, so if you've got honey instead of sugar, feel free to use that instead. You can also skip this ingredient and make a less sweet pie and add sweetener to it later when you eat your pie. You'll next need 30 grams of flour. You've already made flour for the crust, so at least this step is easy. Then you'll need 2.5 grams of cinnamon. This is for flavor. If there's no cinnamon around you, and unless you're near India or Sri Lanka where cinnamon is harvested from the inner bark of several related aromatic trees and then dried, there probably won't be. Footnote. Like silk, the true source of cinnamon was kept secret by Arab traders for over 1,000 years, up to the early 1500 CE, to protect and increase its value. Stories of its origin included fishing it up in nets at the edge of the world, harvesting it from deep canyons protected by terrifying snakes, or collecting it from colossal cinnamon birds who picked up the aromatic sticks from unknown distant lands, using them to build their nests at inaccessible mountaintops near the traders. The traders would slaughter their oxen to trick the greedy birds into collecting the meat. When they return to their nests with the heavy animals, their weight causes the nest to collapse, sending the cinnamon sticks tumbling down the mountain to the traders below. None of this is true. Cinnamon comes from trees. We just said you can find it as the inner bark on aromatic trees. End footnote. You can also experiment with other local spices instead. If it tastes good when you eat it with an apple, it'll probably taste good when you bake it with apples into a pie. 2.5 grams of butter, optional. To make butter from scratch, see section 10.2.5, where we invented butter as a way to make bread taste even better. Instructions for the apple pie. Combine all ingredients in the bowl you used to make the crust earlier and mix them together. The flour is there to thicken your filling, giving you a nice apple pie instead of an apple soup. The other ingredients, sugar, spice, and everything nice, by which we mean butter, are there simply for flavor. Pour the filling into your pie plate, put the top crust on top, poke a few holes to let the steam escape, and cook it in an oven. You can use the kilns you invented in 10.4.2 at 215 degrees centigrade for 15 minutes, then at 190 degrees centigrade for 30 minutes. Don't have thermometers accurate at these temperatures yet? No worries. Just cook it until the crust is golden brown and the filling starts to boil. Let it cool and enjoy. Serve with ice cream. What? Ice cream? You're gosh darn right we're going to serve this with ice cream. Here's how you invent that too. Ice cream. Ice cream is objectively one of the most delicious foods you can enjoy, making it a true shame that it wasn't even invented until the 1700s CE. The earliest approximation of ice cream before that was the snow mixed with honey and fruits that the Greeks were eating around 500 BCE. But if you've ever dumped honey on the snowy ground and tried to eat it, you know, it's not quite the same. Ingredients. Lots of ice. This is the ice part of ice cream. And if you're in a place that doesn't have ice right now, see section 10.2.4 for ways to store ice until summer. You then need 360 grams of cream. Cream is the fattiest part of milk, which you can get from any mammal. If you let milk sit for a while, the fat rises to the top, which you can then skim off to produce both cream and lower-fat milk. If you're tired of waiting, a centrifuge will do the same thing, which again, you can invent by attaching an electric motor, section 10.6.2, to a wheel, using a water wheel instead, or just spinning it around yourself really fast for a while. The next ingredient is 360 grams of milk. If you've got cream, you'll have milk. You'll want to use whole milk here, so use the lower fat milk you produced in the last section for something else. Try putting it in a bowl with some cooked grains to invent breakfast cereal. The next ingredient is 4 chicken eggs. You don't need to domesticate chickens to gain access to their eggs, but it helps. The eggs of any other bird will work here too, just be sure to adjust the number of eggs you're using to the size of the eggs. You'll need 200 grams of sugar, and again any sweetener can be substituted here, and you'll need some of whatever you want your ice cream to taste like. You probably won't have access to vanilla for a while, so vanilla ice cream is out, but local fruits are an easy and hopefully delicious choice. Finally, you'll need 5 grams of salt. This is just to brighten the flavor of your ice cream, and you can adjust the amount you use to your personal taste. See section 10.2.6 for ways to make it. Here's the instructions. Separate the egg yolks from the egg. This is as easy as cracking the egg and carefully pouring out the whites. You can save the whites to make a delicious egg white omelet later, which we don't have a recipe for, but it boils down to add food you want to eat to egg whites and then cook it, probably in the cast iron skillet you invented in section 10.10.2. Whisk the yolks and sugar together until they're combined. This is a critical step. You want them to be mixed well into a thick, disgusting goo. You'll know when you're done when your mixture is a light yellow that falls from your whisk in a single unbroken ribbon. If you haven't invented a whisk, a bunch of sticks works as an extremely practical but extremely unattractive substitute. Heat the milk slowly until it just starts to boil. This is you pasteurizing your milk, see section 10.2.4. Take a small amount and mix it in with the egg and sugar mixture. This is to heat it up so they're less likely to curdle when mixed in with the milk. Once they're warmed up, whisk the egg and sugar mixture into the milk until they're combined as well. Cook them over a low heat, stirring every 30 seconds or so. If you haven't invented a stove in section 10.6.2, a campfire can work fine here. Your goal is to slowly cook the eggs without them becoming scrambled eggs. The secret to doing that is cooking them really slowly as you stir them really often. You'll be done when your mixture reaches a temperature of 76 degrees centigrade, and you will have produced a custard. If you don't have a thermometer, section 10.7.2, you can tell when you're done by the thickness of your custard. Dip your spoon into the mixture, take it out, and then draw your finger across the back of the spoon. If it leaves a clean line, that is to say, if the custard is thick enough that it doesn't drip into the space you just cleaned off, then you're done. Next, strain the custard. If you haven't foraged a metal strainer, you can use fabric to strain it, see section 10.8.4, or skip this step entirely if you don't mind some chunks in your ice cream. Stir in the cream and add in whatever flavorings you want, including the salt, tasting as you go to make sure you like what you're making. Let it cool down again. Now you need to churn this while it stays cool. Churning is easy, in theory. Just move a spoon through it over and over, but after a few minutes, you're going to become as tired as you are bored. To keep the ice cream cool, add salt to your ice, which will lower the freezing point of the water and give you a colder water than can normally be achieved. It'll stay liquid below 0 degrees centigrade. After a while, your cream will thicken into the consistency of a milkshake. At this point, you can freeze it solid, again using the techniques in section 10.2.4, and call it a day. The churning prevents the large ice crystals that would form if you just froze your ice cream directly. And congratulations, you have just made apple pie from scratch and served it a la mode like it wasn't even a big deal. Some may allege that you labored for years to construct an entire civilization just to restore your access to this one single dessert. But let them complain. You've got apple pie and ice cream. The end. This is Ryan North. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of How to Invent Everything, a survival guide for the stranded time traveler. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Linda Korn. Text copyright 2018 by Ryan North, production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House LLC, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.